These are mothers, by the way. Six of the seven, we have their names provided for us in Scripture. On the first one, name two sons of Jochebed. You may want to jot these down, or you may want to just do it in your memory, and then that makes it easier to grade the paper when you're done. You just do it from memory on both parts. Name two sons of Jochebed. Second one, this one may be a little tougher, name two sons of Naomi. Number three, name one son of Ruth. Number four, name one son of Hannah. Number five, we're not told the names of any of her children, so I'm going to have to do this one a little differently. The woman described in Proverbs 31 is said to have a value far above what? You can fill in the blank. And then, for number six, I hope nobody misses this one. This is the Mary who had a child born in Bethlehem. Name that son. And number seven, who was the son of Eunice? If you got all those right, you know what we're going to talk about tonight. Because we are going to talk about the mothers of some very great Bible characters. And these mothers themselves are great Bible characters. And that's the point that I'd like for us to see as we consider them this evening. First of all, just to see how you did on your little quiz there, Jochebed's sons were named Aaron and Moses. Naomi had sons named Mahlon and Chilion. She's better known for her daughter-in-law, Ruth, who was also the mother of Obed. Number four, the son of Hannah was Samuel. The woman of Proverbs is worth far more than rubies. Number six, everybody knows. Number seven, Timothy was the son of Eunice. Let's consider these seven mothers. As I was trying to think about which mothers to choose out of the Bible and focusing on some examples that we can see, there are a number of different ones that could have been chosen, and you might have thought of others that are not on that list that would have come to your mind, who also had important places in the history of the Bible and in the history of the world because of what they contributed. The role of being a mother is perhaps the noblest of all professions. It is a role that was given by God, and He's chosen for that some of the finest people who've ever lived. They've been given a position of guiding young children who would then grow up to have very important roles in their lives, some as mothers themselves, others in various positions in service to God or in various roles as far as our country's development may be concerned. And all of us, I believe, can appreciate the importance of a good mother. Even those big 300-pound guys on TV, when they score the winning point at the football game and they look into the camera and they start waving, every one of them says hi to the dog back home, right? It's always, hi, Mom, because that's who's important to them. Some surveys have been done of what's the sweetest word in the English language or the most beautiful word, and mother is always right up at the top of the list of those words that are nominated. Mothers are important to us. All of us who are here had one. Some of us perhaps have had more than one in some way in our lives. And as we realize their significance and their importance, it's helpful for us to go back and look at the importance of godly mothers as they're presented in the Bible. There's some great examples here. And as we look at these seven women tonight, we're not going to be trying to find one person who presents to us a picture of every aspect of what a mother is, but to look at several different ones and draw from these different mothers some lessons that I think can be helpful to us. First of all, let's go back to the book of Exodus, to the second chapter, and consider Jochebed, the mother of Aaron and Moses. In Exodus chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "A man of the house of Levi went and took as a wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along the river's side, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.' Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?' And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go.' So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages.' So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I drew him out of the water." Jochebed, as the mother of Moses, showed a great concern for the protection of her child in the midst of a society that was bent on the destruction of that same child, a society that had gone to the point of killing babies so as to prevent the Jewish nation from rising up to too much power. And the daughter of the very man who had given that edict became the means of the salvation of that child in a way, taking him in as her own son, but still allowing, perhaps unknowingly, the real mother to be the one to nurse the child. It's also interesting to notice that Jochebed was willing to risk the punishment of being a breaker of the law in order to protect her child. Back in chapter 1 at verse 22, it says that Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." By saving Moses alive and attempting to protect him there in those bulrushes, she was violating the law of Moses, or rather not the law of Moses, the law of Pharaoh, because it was in keeping with the will of God that this child be protected. She also was willing to risk something else. She was willing to sacrifice the honor and recognition that we often think of that goes with being a mother. And even though Moses was going to be recognized as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, she was willing to allow that to happen if it meant being able to preserve him and to rear him as she had desired. There in the 10th verse of chapter 2, it tells us that she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter and he became her son. That had to be a difficult thing to do. But it's what was necessary in the best interests of the child, and being able to keep Moses alive and allow him an opportunity to grow up and to serve God. And so she was willing to put her own interests on the back burner, forget about selfish concerns, and even though she wouldn't be recognized as the mother, at least by many people, she would do what was best to keep the child alive. So we turn over a little bit further in the Old Testament. We come to the book of Ruth, chapter 1. What I'd like for us to do at first here tonight is just to go through and look at these seven mothers, and then we'll talk for a few moments about some lessons that we can learn from them. Naomi is introduced to us in Ruth chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread." And then in verse 16, to skip through part of this account to get to Ruth's comments, as Ruth determined that she was going to stay with Naomi and return with her, Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." The interesting thing about Naomi is that the focus is not so much on her relationship with the children who were born to her. It tells us that they died and she was left a childless widow. But the relationship instead is focusing on her daughter-in-law, her role as an in-law. And in that, as we see her instruction, we can see a lesson that many families today need. Naomi accepted her daughter-in-law. In fact, it seems that she showed acceptance toward both of those. There are too many families in this world where there is a strife that there's the us and them approach to in-law relationships. That we have our children and then we have these people who are kind of outsiders who married our children. Or we have our parents and then we have the other ones. Some of you heard me a little bit this week. I pick on my mother-in-law incessantly. But that's only because she deserves it. I'm talking about normal relationships. Now, my mother-in-law have a very good relationship, and that enables us to, since we're both a little bit of the teasing kind, to focus in on each other and pick on each other a little bit. But it's important for us to learn some things here. Naomi had earned the respect of her daughter-in-law so that she could be accepted as a parent, to the point that Ruth would leave her own relatives there in Moab and would go with Naomi to her country. In the process of treating her daughter-in-law with respect and with love and with acceptance and with living before her an example of a woman who was devoted to her faith in God, Naomi accomplished the most important thing she could have for Ruth. She converted her to her God. Even in a time when evangelism was not really a particular concern for the Jewish people, when they were not given a commission to go into all the world and preach the gospel as we have been given in the New Testament, she still, by her example, won this young woman to want to follow after Jehovah. By the same kind of treatment of our relatives and our in-laws, we can often provide the kind of example and instruction that can win the daughters-in-law and the sons-in-law, and that can win the fathers-in-law and mothers-in-law who may not already be children of God. Let's make sure that we learn some of those lessons from Naomi. And while we're in the same book, there's some things we can learn from Ruth. Not only was she a good example of a daughter-in-law, but she was also an important example as far as a mother is concerned. Ruth followed Naomi and showed her commitment to God and to her mother-in-law, was not going to leave this woman to go back as a bitter older woman to Judah and there to die in sadness and grief, but instead went with her, placing the interests of her mother-in-law as of prime importance to her. And God blessed Ruth in other ways. He saw that Ruth was provided with further care for her and that also turned to the benefit of her mother-in-law. Boaz took a particular interest in this kinswoman by marriage, and as he was able to then have the right to redeem her, as a closer relative waived his opportunity to redeem her, under the law of Moses, he was then able to take her as his wife. And then, in chapter 4 of the book of Ruth, at verse 13, it says that Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. We're not told a great deal about Ruth's role as a mother, but we are told that she was privileged to become an ancestor of Jesus Christ. In verse 17 of this chapter, it says, "Also the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, 'There is a son born to Naomi,' and they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David, and his lineage is carried right on down. It includes Jesus Christ himself." Because of her demonstration of fidelity to God and her family, and going through the kind of a courtship that we need to imitate, where Boaz and Ruth took an interest in each other at a godly level, and for wanting to do the things that were right and just and in keeping with the will of God, Boaz won her heart, won her hand, and she brought forth a child that was an ancestor of Jesus. As we turn over a page or so beyond that, we come to the first chapter of 1 Samuel, where we meet another woman who also tells us some important things about the attitudes of mothers that mothers ought to show today. Let's read a few verses in 1 Samuel chapter 1. First of all, verse 11. Speaking of Hannah, it says, "She made a vow and said, 'O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head.'" That was a reference to the Nazarite vow, which would have dedicated him. But this son was going to be dedicated on a continuing basis. It was not simply a temporary vow, as was often done with that particular Nazarite vow. In verse 15, as Hannah is questioned by Eli, who thinks that she's drunk and she needs to quit her drinking, she says, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord." And then down in the latter part of verse 19, it says that Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked for him from the Lord." And then in verse 27, we see a little more of the story. As she presents Samuel to Eli at the temple, rather at the tabernacle, she says, "For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition which I asked of him. Therefore I also have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord." So they worship the Lord there. There's obviously more in the account here that we could pull out some of the details, but notice a few of the things that we see about Hannah. One was that this woman had a strong desire for the blessing of having a child. And we're going to talk in a few moments about the significance of that desire. She viewed this child as a great blessing from God, and so she prayed to God. And when she was given indication from God that her prayer was answered, she trusted Him, and then she followed through with her promise. Realizing how greatly she was blessed to be given this child, she dedicated the child to the Lord. In fact, it's interesting to notice that she seemed to count it a privilege to give him up to serve God. Could you have done that? Could you have taken a child at a very tender young age and allowed him to leave home and to live somewhere else because he was going to be dedicated to God for the rest of his life? You'd see him on occasional visits, but he would not be in your care and your control because you had turned him over to God. That had to be a terribly difficult thing. And it would seem that Hannah would have been suffering from all those normal temptations and motherly instincts that after the child was born and she'd held him and she'd cuddled him and she'd nursed him, and as the day drew closer and closer that he was to be weaned and turned over for this service, that she'd want to say, well, now, wait a minute, I'm not so sure about this. But she'd made a vow to God. And she had made a vow because she realized that it was a great blessing to be able to present a child to the service of God. And I don't know if I could have done what she and her husband did, but it tells us that when this child was taken to be turned over to service, the very last line of verse 28 in chapter 1 says that they worshiped the Lord there. And Hannah prayed and said, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you, nor is there any rock like our God." And she goes on to praise God and to give thanks to Him because He allowed her to have this child, even though she did not have the child with her for any great length of time. We need to recognize the privilege of having our children, regardless of how long it is, and to be thankful to God for that privilege. And when we have opportunity to, in a sense, give them up to the service of God, that we're willing to do that, just as Hannah was. In Proverbs chapter 31, we read about a woman who is not identified for us by name, but pretty well known as that virtuous woman whose worth is far above rubies. The virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 has been talked about perhaps as much as any woman in the Bible. You'll hear these verses that we're about to read, starting in verse 10, read at many funerals in reference to those who have been faithful wives and mothers and godly women. And there are verses that we ought to read. They're verses that are sometimes read as we are preparing for marriage to remind us that this is what we ought to be looking for. And I'd encourage that we think about them, especially young men who have not yet married. Think about what's being described here. It's very natural for us when we're in those early years to be looking at the things which are very fleeting and often very unimportant, looking for the physical attractiveness and so on. And those things don't last in many cases. There's, at least they don't stay exactly the same. There's a different beauty that develops with age. And the beauty that this wise man was to be looking for was not a beauty of the outward woman, it was a beauty of the inward person. That's the beauty that endures throughout this life and eternity. And it's the beauty that he tells us to look for. Proverbs 31, verse 10. King Lemuel tells us what his mother had taught him. When he says, "Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good, and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. We can't go in the time we have tonight into the details of what's provided there, but notice this composite picture that's put together for us of the virtuous woman. A woman who is industrious, who is devoted to her family, who is not out for advancing in a career, she's out for advancing the cause of her family. A woman who is not ashamed that her primary function in life is for the advancement of her husband and her children. A woman who wouldn't flinch when asked to speak at the graduation at a college that said, "We don't want somebody here whose main accomplishment in life is supporting her husband." But who'd be willing to go ahead and address that kind of an issue because there's nothing to be ashamed of in living in a way that her husband was well spoken of and was able to sit with the elders at the gates. A woman who would be honored by her children, as they would someday be able to look back and see all the sacrifices of those late nights and early mornings of labor that she had put forth for them. That's the woman who is worth far more than rubies. It's not described as the woman whose physical beauty is stunning and it just causes everybody to stop in their tracks. It's the woman who is showing an inward beauty that cannot be matched by anything that man might try to imitate. In Luke chapter 2, we meet another of the great mothers of the Bible. Some of these others we've looked at are not quite as well known, but I don't think we could have a very complete list here without giving some thought to the woman that God chose to be the mother of His Son. What a task, what an opportunity, what a privilege Mary was given. In Luke chapter 2 at verse 33, it says that Joseph and his mother marveled at those things which were spoken of him. This is as Simeon is speaking of Jesus, as he'd been presented in Jerusalem. Then Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, "Behold, this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign which will be spoken against. Yes, a sword will pierce through your own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed." Would you bring a child into this world if you knew that child was going to have a rough life of abuse and persecution and was probably going to die a premature death and you were going to suffer all the pain of that? Mary did. We're not told exactly all that she was told in advance, but with the benefit of Old Testament prophecy and some clues that were given to her, she knew some things about Jesus. And she learned more as time went on. In verse 51 of Luke 2, it says that he went down with them, that is, Jesus went down with them and came to Nazareth at the age of 12 here, and he was subject to them, but his mother kept all these things in her heart. What a full heart she must have had, as she had accumulated all these things happening to her son over the years. And then as we go on a little further in the account, the book of John, chapter 19, we see Mary in another circumstance. Jesus has now grown up. He has spent a few years teaching his message. He has been abused and persecuted. And in John chapter 19, verse 25, it says, "There stood by the cross of Jesus his mother." What a task that must have been. Jesus there by the cross watching as, Jesus on the cross and his mother there watching as he was being killed. The fact that Mary stood by the cross of Jesus stands as one of the greatest evidences the Bible ever presents to us of the reality of the claims that he made. The whole case against Jesus was built on the concept of blasphemy. Here is a man who claims to be God. Mary had given birth to that man some 30-odd years earlier. She was the only person alive who could know from her own personal and physical involvement who the real father of that child was. And Mary stood by the cross and watched them kill her son, never once speaking up and saying, "He's deluded, he's believed a lie that I concocted when I was just a teenage mother and trying to get out of the responsibility of this pregnancy. Never once did she speak up and try to preserve the life of that son, but she watched him die. And she herself became a disciple, followed him even after the resurrection. She was there in Jerusalem. Her other sons, who were unbelievers while Jesus walked the face of the earth, also became followers of him, providing for us even some of the writings that we have in the New Testament. Mary knew the truth about Jesus, and she allowed him to go to his death, silently watching, because she knew Jesus was not an illegitimate child conceived from a man out of wedlock. She was bearing the child of God. And as the mother of this child of God, she watched him die. She suffered the pain. There was wonder for her, but there was also pain as she accepted the will of God. Back in Luke chapter 1, it makes another comment about her in verse 28. As Gabriel had come to her to announce the birth of Jesus, that he was going to be born, it says in verse 28 that having come in, the angel said to her, "Rejoice, highly favored one. The Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women." Yes, blessed among women. But pain with that blessing. Verse 38, Mary said, "Behold, the maidservant of the Lord, let it be to me according to your word." And the angel departed from her. She accepted it, but she suffered because of it. When we accept roles as parents, sometimes they will bring suffering. There will be heartache. And it's not always the heartache of seeing an innocent child suffer as it was here. There will sometimes be the heartache, as we talked about last night, of seeing children that turn out bad. There will be the heartache of seeing them suffer things that are beyond their control, and the heartache of seeing them suffer consequences of their own mistakes. But let's not approach the whole idea of being parents with a pessimism that holds us back from doing it simply because there might be heartache and there might be pain. Mary suffered heartache as a mother, but she was blessed above other women in being allowed that opportunity to be the earthly mother of Jesus Christ. In Acts chapter 16, we meet another woman. And this is a woman that I think we need to perhaps focus on more sometimes in our studies of Bible women. Some of the things that we can learn from Eunice as we read about her role as the mother of Timothy. In Acts chapter 16, verse 1, speaking here of Paul's work as he and Silas were traveling, it says that he came to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. To put the pieces together, and then we're going to come back and look at some points about Eunice. In 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5, as Paul is writing to this young preacher who had become like a son to him, he says that I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also. And then in chapter 3 of that book, in verse 14, but as for you, continue in the things which you have learned and been assured of, knowing from whom you have learned them, and that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. Timothy was provided instruction from the time he was a youngster. Probably that instruction was first in an understanding of the law of Moses. But then, as they found this more complete revelation in Jesus Christ, his mother and his grandmother and Timothy himself turned to that. One of the things to notice about the role of Eunice is that she taught her son the Scriptures. That faith dwelt in him from an early age because he learned it. Every once in a while, people will make comments almost in derision of those that they describe as second-generation Christians. And the comment will be made that second-generation Christians don't have the kind of faith that first-generation Christians do because they don't appreciate what they've left behind. Sometimes their comment's true. But it doesn't have to be true. And it doesn't have to be that there's something wrong with us if our parents were Christians. We need to count that a privilege if they were Christians and we were able to have some guidance. And if by their guidance we avoided some of the pitfalls that are in the world, be thankful for that. Because that may have left us in a position that we can be useful to some other things. I believe that there are times when those who were converted as adults can appreciate more fully than some others do the significance of salvation. But if we have difficulty appreciating it, we need to remember that those little sins that the world might describe were just as serious a crimes before God. And that even if our parents and grandparents were Christians, that we needed the salvation that's offered by the grace of Jesus just as much as the next person. We were all, without excuse, condemned before God. And there is nothing wrong with having parents and grandparents and great-grandparents who also had had the privilege of hearing the gospel and responding to it. The danger of those comments that are sometimes made is that it can almost discourage us as parents from doing anything to really guide our children. Well, they need to learn for themselves, and they'll appreciate it more if they go out in the world and make a mess of their lives first. Don't buy into that kind of logic. And young people, don't feel like you've got to go out and do everything that the world can offer before you're going to appreciate what it is to be a Christian. If you're old enough to understand the will of God, you can look at things in your own life and realize how much you need salvation. That's all the appreciation that's necessary. Come to Christ and be willing to commit yourself to Him early. Because so many of those who decide they're going to go and explore never get done exploring. They die in the fields of exploration and they never come back home. Don't be afraid of learning from your parents and applying the things that they teach. Eunice also set an example for Timothy in the faith that she showed in her life. And something that I think is a very important lesson about Eunice that so often is overlooked is to realize that she was able to rear this godly son without the cooperation of a husband who shared the same concerns. Did you notice the way it was described back there in Acts 16:1? Here was this mother who was a Jew, but the father was a Greek. He was a Gentile. The clear implication of that seems to be that the father was not involved in this effort of rearing Timothy. It was the work of the mother and the help of the grandmother. Some of you are in that very position. You are parents who are having to rear children without the cooperation of a spouse. Maybe you don't have a spouse to help you. Maybe the spouse is not concerned about godly and spiritual matters and is not sharing your faith, and you've got to struggle with it alone. Don't give up. It's not impossible. Some of the finest Christians I know today came up in families just like that, where there was one parent who did not care about spiritual things, but the other one who tried extra hard and persisted and provided the instruction that was necessary. Don't give up on your children just because the odds are stacked a little tougher against you. Give it everything you've got. Give them everything they need as far as their spiritual instruction. We do not have to make excuses for failure. What we need to do is find the methods of success. And God has provided them for us if we'll study them and use them. There's something else about the example of Eunice where this young man Timothy was concerned. In Acts chapter 16, verse 3, it says, Paul wanted to have him go on with him. And he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region, for they all knew that his father was Greek. Paul took this young man Timothy out on a trip through all the treacherous travel that he was going to be involved in. Timothy's life was at risk to go preach the gospel. And you know what his mother did? She let him go. That's not an easy one, is it? We live in a world today that has so much opportunity for the gospel to be carried. I read an article recently of a young man who'd gone into Russia at some significant risk to his own life, was deported within 3 months, but had the opportunity to teach a number of people, to baptize several, and to distribute hundreds or perhaps thousands of Bibles that had been smuggled in. Yes, it was against the law. So was a lot of what Paul and Peter and John did in the New Testament. And yes, his life was at risk in a way that perhaps most of us have not put ours at risk. I don't know if his mother was a Christian and was aware of what he was doing when he went over there or not. If she was, it was probably difficult to let go and watch him face that risk. But the sad thing that's developed in our country and in many times in the church is the scenario where if troops are called to go to Iraq to enter into a war, we'll give our sons a pat on the back and send them off to fight in that war. But when we've got a war against Satan that requires that they go to some distant part of the world and risk their lives there, we don't want them to go because it's not safe over there. What war are we trying to win in this life? God didn't put us here for the purpose of dominating the world militarily. He put us here for the purpose of defeating Satan on a day-by-day basis. If we'd risk our lives in physical war and would not be willing to risk them in the spiritual warfare against Satan, are we really devoted followers of Christ? And if we are going to have men and women who will risk their lives in that way, it will demand mothers and fathers who will be willing to let them go and willing to put them at those risks and allow them to take those chances. Well, what I'd like for us to think about for the next few moments is these mothers, moving them out of their biblical context, and we want to bring them to the year 1990. If they were here in our society, in our culture today, what would they have to say about some of the things that are so prevalent in our time and today? What would some of these mothers say about a country that kills 1.5 million babies a year through legalized abortion? What do you think Jochebed would have to say about that? A woman who was willing to risk her own life to keep a child alive. A woman who was willing to give up her position as a mother if that's what it required to keep that child alive. What do you think Hannah would say about that? A woman who was barren and prayed to God for that privilege of having a child and said, "If you give him to me, I'll give him up to your service." And we live in a society that has become so barbarous that we kill our own innocent young. And the crime is extending beyond abortion. That one by itself is bad enough. It's extending beyond abortion to the point that we're hearing incidents of people being released in court cases where they have killed their children immediately after birth when they found that the child was somewhat deformed. Things as simple as a cleft palate being used as an excuse for bashing a child's head into the wall right there in the delivery room. And it's also extending to the crimes of if we can kill our innocent young, we can kill our innocent elderly. And the excuses that are being offered for killing those who have become helpless as they have aged. It's coming to the point that there are people who are writing articles representing American societies of doctors and pediatricians and so on, and saying that there is nothing that makes a human life worth anything intrinsically more than the life of a pig. And that there may be some human beings who are not worth as much as a healthy pig. That's in the United States, in our day and age. Can you imagine how women like Jochebed and Hannah would have to feel about those kinds of attitudes? The attitude that is behind this problem of abortion is the one that ought to concern us so much. It is a selfishness that has put self above anything else and will get rid of whatever's in the way, including taking the life of an unborn child. What about in our day and age when there are women who are so concerned about advancing their careers at the expense of their family that the families are often left to just kind of grow up on their own? It's no longer like a gardener who takes pride in developing those beautiful flowers, but it's like somebody who has weeds in the backyard and doesn't bother to trim them very often. What do you think the virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 would have had to say about that? Yes, she was involved in outside business affairs. She went and bought a field, and she was taking her merchandise to be sold. She was a businesswoman, but for the purpose of providing for her family, and not to the neglect of her family. What we have had that's developed in our day and age is a concern of having material things and having them now that just won't wait. We're an impatient people. We, many of us, have lived in nicer and bigger homes by the time we've been married for 5 or 10 years than our parents lived in by the time they've been married for 30 or 40, or all their lives. Isn't that right? And we've driven nicer cars, and we've had more material things than the people just a generation before us. And then we talk about how it's necessary for both husband and wife to go out and work at the neglect of young children at home because we have to do it to survive. Do we? Do we? Or are we so accustomed to such a level of affluence and providing so many material things for those children that we are taking away from them the very things that they need the most? I've watched as young families have struggled when a man's been out there working on a job that didn't pay a great wage, and his wife stayed at home because the children needed her there. And I've watched in those situations as sometimes they've done without things that all the neighbors had, and they've lived in rented apartments and houses that weren't nearly as nice as some of the other kids that went to school with them. But the children from those families rise up to call them blessed. You see, we get old enough that we forget about having to wear patches on the clothes when it wasn't fashionable to tear your clothes before you wear them. And we get old enough to forget about eating the simple meals where once in a while you go for a day or two without having meat in the meal. What we remember is the mother that cared enough to provide us what we really needed, and the father who was willing to swallow his pride a little bit and say, we may not have everything that the people down the street have, but we'll have something more important. That's what we need to give our children to remember. We need to be willing to let them do without some of the material things. And we need to be willing to do without them, to give them what they need. What would these women have said to those who are caught up in our time in all these worldly pursuits instead of the things which are of God? Women like Hannah, Ruth, the virtuous woman of Proverbs. What would these women have said to those of us who have serious in-law problems, where even though father-in-law and mother-in-law and son-in-law and daughter-in-law all claim to be Christians, but they still hate each other, still can't get along? We got to treat each other as Christians are supposed to. And if the in-laws are not Christians, we still treat them with the same respect we should any other human being. And Ruth and Naomi can tell us some things about that from both angles, mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. What will these women say about the challenges of rearing godly children without the help and agreement of the spouse? Eunice tells us some things about that from her example. And what would they tell us about rearing children who will truly succeed in life? Perhaps not as doctors and lawyers and physicists and so on, but people who will do the things that really matter. Jochebed, the mother of Moses, who led the people of God out of their bondage. Hannah, the mother of Samuel, one of the great priests and prophets. Mary, the mother of Jesus Christ. Eunice, the mother of this young man, Timothy, who was willing to go into dangerous places to preach. Though they might tell us that there was pain in what they did, often separation, even at an early age. But wouldn't they tell us to prepare our children to be men and women of God so that we can enjoy eternity together with them? Their example rings out so loudly on that point. But as we think about what these mothers would say to us, last thing I'd like for us to think about is what we need to be saying to mothers like that. It's far too easy for us to take for granted what our mothers have done for us. And I'd like to share with you quotations from three individuals who acknowledged the role of their mothers. George Washington said, "The greatest teacher I ever had was my mother." 15 presidents later, number 16, Abraham Lincoln said, "All that I am and all that I ever hope to be, I owe to my mother." He also said, "No man is poor when he has a godly mother." A more contemporary author by the name of Jody Moore had this to say about thanking mothers, more accurately about thanking God for them. "Thank you, God, for pretending not to notice that one of your angels is missing, and for guiding her to me. You must have known how much I would need her, so you turned your head for a moment and allowed her to slip away to me. Sometimes I wonder what special name you had for her. I call her Mother. To think of not having her with me is unbearable. I do not know what I would have done without her all these years. She has loved me without reservation, whether I deserve to be loved or not. Willingly and happily she has fed and clothed me, taught me, encouraged me, inspired me, and with her own special brand of gentleness, reprimanded me. A bit of heaven's own blue, her eyes reflect hope and love for you and her family. She has tried to instill that love in us. She's not the least bit afraid of work. With her constant scrubbing, polishing, painting, and fixing, she has made every house we ever lived in a beautiful home. When I am confused, she sets me straight. She knows what matters and what does not, what to hold on to and what to let go. You have given her an endless supply of love. She gives it away freely, yet never seems to run low. Even before I am aware that I have a need, she is making plans and working to supply it. You gave her great patience. She is the best listener I've ever met. With understanding and determination, she always seems to turn a calamity into some kind of success. She urges me to carry my own load in life, but is always close by if I stumble under the burden. She hurts when I hurt. She cries when I cry. And she will not be happy until she has seen a smile on my face once more. Although she has taught me to pray, she has never ceased to invoke your richest blessings upon me. Thank the other angels for filling in for her while she is away. I know it has not been easy. her shoes would be hard to fill. She has to be one of your greatest miracles, God. And I want to thank you for lending my mother to me. A little less than 2 years ago, I had an opportunity that there are many people who would love to have. I had the opportunity to sit on the edge of my bed, my mother's bed, a few days before she died, the last day that she was really conscious and aware of much of what was being discussed. And we talked about what she had done as a mother and as a wife, what she'd given to us. God gave me the opportunity to say thank you and to say it to her while she was alive. I've known a lot of people who suffered the rest of their lives because they didn't take that kind of an opportunity when they had it. We don't always have warning that death is coming in a matter of days, as we had with my mother. We're not always given those opportunities where we can sit down and frankly say, this is going to be the last time we talk on this earth, but thank you